Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Today we're talking about Book 12, Chapter 4. What did Grushenka just do? She seemed to have done something with her testimony. And general discussion. Those are the questions that I asked you guys about the chapter. Tekrific said, I am massively proud and impressed by our little community that we collectively pieced together the carefully nothing here to see ruse of Dostoevsky, and that we managed to see through the red herrings he left for us. Pat yourselves on the back, gang, we deserve it. I attribute our success to the slow reading tempo and the astuteness of the group. I kind of feels like the red herring was the culprit. Like, you know, a murder mystery, the typical setup of a murder mystery. There's the crime, and then there's the obvious person who you're like, oh, they just did the murder. It's obvious. Like, the very first thing you think. And that, in this case, was Mitya, you know. And I completely fell for that. I'm like, oh, did he just kill his dad? Wow. And then you get the red herring, which is like, you know, shortly after that, you go, ah, oh, wait a second. I know who it was. And you figure it out, right? And there's this other person who could be guilty. And that's where they kind of throw you, and you're like, oh, you know, it's definitely that person. You think you've figured it out. That's the red herring. But that's never the who. That's never who done it, right? Because then that's too obvious. It's like, it's not the person who it obviously is. And then it's not that first person where you figure it out and be like, ah, I get it. It wasn't the obvious person. It was this other equally obvious person. But then it never, like, that's the thing about the mystery. So you think you've figured it out. You think you know the twist, and then boom, something else comes in out of nowhere, or something unexpected happens, or the tables are turned, you know? But in this, it was just like a straight 1-2. It was like, oh, Mitya did it. Oh, wait a minute. It might have been this other guy. Yes, I was correct. It was the other guy. It's just like, I don't know. It's, there's nothing to it, really, is there? It was, maybe it was because of the slow pace or something like that, but I don't know. It seemed a bit obvious. Onwards. Okay, onwards, says Tekrific. Alyosha's honesty and integrity has gained him a well-earned reputation. Cashing in on that reputation with a sudden recall, at first, we had nothing in his evidence that would sway anybody, but the anecdote about the hidden money on Mitch's person is a step towards at least sowing a seed of doubt. I must admit Katerina's willingness to expose her own vulnerability and subsequent blow to her reputation and integrity is impressive. Given that we identify her flaw as pride, the same as Ivan's, this was uncharacteristic of her, or maybe we've judged her too harshly. Is she proud? I had no idea. Mitch's impulse to help Katerina is painted in quite a different light than how Mitya knows it to really be. His shame is increased, not diminished, but only he knows it, hence his outbursts. As for Grushenka, maybe her fatal flaw is pride too, also jealousy. So many of our characters are so highly rung, like taut copper wires, ready to shatter at any moment. It's that Russian cliche that never seems to want to go away and that Dosto keeps adding fuel to. Why did she have to attack Katerina? Her jealous nature couldn't simply cease and desist. And here we are. Her relation to Rakitin came as a total surprise to me, but she did manage to reduce his testimony to naught. So I guess she did some good as a witness. Yeah, the characters in Dostoevsky have this kind of, I don't know, they're too amped up, it feels. I feel like the characters in War and Peace, just to compare back to Tolstoy, were much more realistic, because you had people that were wound up, but then you also had people that were shy. You had people that were, like Pierre, he's kind of hapless, and how would you describe Pierre? He's a bit of a pushover, and he's patient, and he's soft-spoken. But you do have characters that are dialed up and that are a bit, you know, overbearing. But mostly, you also have just, like, kind of healthy people, right? And sure, they deal with trauma, and they do deal with tragedy and that kind of thing, and they have moments where they're not healthy, but overall, they're healthy people. They don't have some kind of, like, mental defect, whereas everyone in this book seems to have some kind of personality disorder or something. They're all just off the charts. Like, even Alyosha, it's like, what are you trying to suppress there with all this virtue? You know what I mean? Like, both of your brothers seem to have severe personality disorders, and your father as well. And here you are at this complete opposite extreme as a monk in a monastery. And it's like, you know what? I kind of feel like it's the same thing. It's just manifested at the other end of the scale, because it's, there's no just normal person, you know? You know what I mean? Like, there's no one who's in that family who's just a chill dude, right? And there seems to be no one in the book who's just a chill dude. That's what this book is missing, just chilled dudes. Laura Y. Stitch said, I'm massively proud and impressed by our little community. Well, as Herzen Stube says, if a man has one head, it's good, but if another clever man comes to visit him, it would be better still, for then there will be two heads and not only one. Turns out, says Tegrific, turns out Herzen Stube knows a thing or two. Yeah, we put our heads together. That's what we did. That's what this community is about. I think we're getting so much out of these books. We're really kind of ringing them out. I don't know. I was going to say wringing their necks, but that doesn't sound right. We're squeezing out every little detail, which is great. I am Norwegian, said Alyosha, realized just now why Dimitri was hitting himself in the chest with his finger. They should have asked Tegrific. He figured it out hundreds of pages ago. Ha. Had it not been for a certain incident, the accused would have at least have received a lighter sentence. This is the first confirmation that Dimitri is going to get a sentence, right? I am assuming that Dimitri is also on the stand for his crimes against Grigory. He did leave him for dead, after all. It seems like a strange bit of evidence, just to have the brother say, I saw him do a thing, with no, there really is no evidence, it's just his word. And I suppose like Tegrific said, he's got a lot of goodwill towards him, so he's kind of cashed that in, so they are taking his word for it. But even at that, they're just believing him that he pointed to a slightly different piece of his chest, and that's where the fulcrum tips the balance for this whole case of did he point to the part of his chest where his heart is, or slightly next to that part. Swim said, the mama fishy said, so I found this website that by the way, I'm really happy I just used the word fulcrum. I think you need to use that one often. Swim said, the mama fishy said, so I found this website that compares the Brothers Karamazov to various story tropes. One compared Katerina and Grushenka to Betty and Veronica from the Archie comics. I can see that kinda. Glad to see Grushenka publicly embarrasses Ratkeeton. Damn, I've actually never read the Archie comics, so that reference is completely lost on me, but I really wish I had so that I could get a bit of a clearer picture of Katerina and Grushenka. Uncle Jossel Mayer said, I'm going to sneeze, actually, in somewhere between 5 seconds and 2 minutes. Uncle Jossel Mayer said, in Dostoevsky's time, there was a current of thinkers that wanted to understand feelings, passions, criminality with the precision and determinism of physical laws. Charles Fourier, Adolf Quetelet, and many others. They made use of mechanical and thermodynamical concepts to talk about emotions and passions. We can notice their influence on Sigmund Freud's work. Fourier tried to equal his theory about passions. I love this, by the way. Equal his theory about passions with the physics science. Physics? Yeah, physics science. Said that emotions attract each other the same way gravity does with objects. Quetelet, using math calculations, said that criminality was a statistic phenomenon in society. There's a natural percentage of murderers, robbers, and prostitution that is unavoidable. We cannot elude them because those facts are part of nature's laws. Dostoevsky rebelled against all that scientific ideas. I like that you've lumped in murderers, robbers, and prostitutes in one thing. I think prostitution isn't even a crime here, is it? Who knows? Anyway, I see your point, though. We cannot elude them because those facts are part of nature's laws. Dostoevsky rebelled against all that scientific ideas that represented the human being as a gear with our soul trapped in the social machine. Of course that we can do something to stop violence, he thought. Of course that we can reject bad emotions. The charity that someone shows for other human beings is something you cannot predict in any logarithm, and even eludes the scope of any statistics. What's a logarithm, by the way, as opposed to an algorithm? A quantity representing the power to which a fixed number must be raised to produce a given number. Maths. I'm very confused, and I have no idea what I just said. For him, the most important object of study was the human being, his soul, and the meaning of his life. Dostoevsky wasn't naive. He preached love and compassion, not because he was a simple-minded idealist. He knew the darkest corners of the human soul. He knew the evil meanderings of the mind that made him ponder that the only route of action to end the sufferings of humankind was through charity and love. For him, human dignity and soul are beyond the understanding of any science or human institution. In Dmitri's trial, all theories and statistics and even common sense manifest his guiltiness, but Dostoevsky seems to say, wait and look closer. What if, with all our science, with all our wisdom, we are still wrong? How many times have we punished not the real criminals, but the collateral victims of the murderers we freed? Scary thought, you know. Of all the people that have pleaded innocent and been proven guilty, I bet there's a there must be a percentage of those that are incorrectly proven guilty. And what would that percentage be? It's a terrifying thought. You know, it might be 1%. It might be 10%. You know, who knows? All right. That's that. That's that one. I need to sniff/sneeze. Excuse me. Sorry about that. Okay, that's the discussion chapter. Let's move on. Let's read chapter 5, which is 1, 2, 4, 6, 8 pages long. Awesome. Chapter 5, A Sudden Catastrophe. I may note that he had been called before Alyosha, but the usher of the court announced to the president that owing to an attack of illness or some sort of fit, the witness could not appear at that moment, but was ready to give his evidence as soon as he recovered. But no one seemed to have heard it. And it only came... And it only came out later. Man, one paragraph in, I'm already yawning. His entrance was for the first moment almost unnoticed. The principal witnesses, especially the two rival ladies, had already been questioned. Curiosity was satisfied for the first time. The public was feeling almost fatigued. Several more witnesses were still to be heard, who probably had little information to give after all that had been given. Time was passing. Ivan walked up with his extraordinary slowness, looking at no one, and with his head bowed, as though plunged in gloomy thought. He was irreproachably dressed, but his face made a painful impression, on me at least. There was an earthly look in it. A look like a dying man's. His eyes were lustreless. He raised them and slowly looked around the court. Alyosha jumped up from his seat and moaned, "Ah!" I remember that, but it was hardly noticed. The president began by informing him that he was a witness, not on oath, that he might answer or refuse to answer, but that, of course, he must bear witness according to his conscience, and so on and so on. Ivan listened and looked at him blankly, but his face gradually relaxed into a smile, and as soon as the president, looking at him in astonishment, finished, he laughed outright. "Well, and what else?" he asked in a loud voice. There was a hush in the court. There was a feeling of something strange. The president showed signs of uneasiness. "You are perhaps still unwell," he began, looking everywhere for the usher. "Don't trouble yourself, Your Excellency. I am well enough, and can tell you something interesting," Ivan answered with sudden calmness and respectfulness. "You have some special communication to make," the president went on, still mistrustfully. Ivan looked down, waited a few seconds, and raising his head, answered almost stammering, "No, I haven't. I have nothing particular." They began asking him questions. He answered, as it were, reluctantly, with extreme brevity, with a sort of disgust which grew more and more marked, though he answered rationally. To many questions, he answered that he did not know. He knew nothing of his father's money relations with Dmitri, I was interested in the subject, he added. Threats to murder his father, he had heard from the prisoner. Of the money in the envelope, he had heard from Smerdyakov. The same thing over and over, he interrupted suddenly with a look of weariness. I have nothing particular to tell the court. I see you are unwell and understand your feelings, the president began. He turned to the prosecutor and the counsel for the defense to invite them to examine the witness, if necessary. When Ivan suddenly asked, in an exhausted voice, "Let me go, Your Excellency, I feel very ill." And with these words, without waiting for permission, he turned to walk out of the court, but after taking four steps, he stood still as though he had reached a decision, smiled slowly, and went back. "I am like a peasant girl, Your Excellency, you know. How does it go? I'll stand up if I like, and I won't if I don't. They were trying to put on her sarafan to take her to church to be married, and she said, 'I'll stand up if I like, and I won't if I don't.' It's in some book about the peasantry." "What do you mean by that?" the president asked severely. "Why, this." Ivan suddenly pulled out a roll of notes. "Here's the money, the notes that lay in that envelope." He nodded towards the table on which lay the material evidence, "for the sake of which our father was murdered. Where shall I put them, Mr. Superintendent? Take them." The usher of the court took the whole roll and handed it to the president. "How could this money have come into your possession if it is the same money?" the president asked wonderingly. "I got them from Smerdyakov, from the murderer, yesterday. I was with him just before he hanged himself. It was he, not my brother, who killed our father. He murdered him, and I enticed him to do it. Who doesn't desire his father's death?" "Are you in your right mind?" broke involuntarily from the president. "I should think I am in my right mind. In the same nasty mind as all of you, or as all these ugly faces." Oh. He turned suddenly to the audience. "My father has been murdered, and they pretend they are horrified," he snarled with furious contempt. "They keep up the sham with one another, liars. They all desire the death of their fathers. One reptile devours another. If there hadn't been a murder, they'd have been angry and gone home ill-humoured. It's a spectacle they want. Panem et circenses, bread and circuses, though I am one to talk. Have you any water? Give me a drink, for Christ's sake." He suddenly clutched his head. The usher at once approached him. Alyosha jumped up and cried, "He is ill. Don't believe him. He has brain fever." Katerina Ivanovna rose impulsively from her seat and with rigid horror gazed at Ivan. Mitya stood up and greedily looked at his brother and listened to him with a wild, strange smile. "Don't disturb yourselves. I am not mad. I am only a murderer," Ivan began again. "You can expect eloquence from a murderer. You can't expect eloquence from a murderer," he added suddenly, for some reason, and laughed a queer laugh. The prosecutor bent over to the president in obvious dismay. The two other judges communicated in agitated whispers. Petukovich pricked up his ears as he listened. The wall was hushed in expectation. The president seemed suddenly to recollect himself. "Witness, your words are incomprehensible and impossible here. Calm yourself if you can and tell your story. If you have something to tell, how can you confirm your statement if indeed you are not delirious?" "That's just it. I have no proof. That cur, Smerdyakov, won't send you proofs from the other world in an envelope. You think of nothing but envelopes. One is enough." "I've no witnesses, except one, perhaps," he smiled thoughtfully. "Who is your witness?" "He has a tail, Your Excellency, and that would be irregular. Le diable ne exist point. Don't pay attention, he's a paltry, pitiful devil," he added suddenly. He ceased laughing and spoke, as it were, confidently. "And here is somewhere, no doubt, under the table, with that material evidence on it, perhaps. Where should he sit, if not there? You see, listen to me, I told him I don't want to keep quiet, and he talked about the geological cataclysm. Idiocy. Come, release the monster, he's been singing a hymn. That's because his heart is light. It's like a drunken man in the street bawling how Vanka went to Petersburg, and I would give a quadrillion for 2 seconds of joy. You don't know me. Oh, how stupid all this business is. Come, take me instead of him. I don't come for nothing. Why is everything so stupid?" And he began slowly, as it were reflectively, looking around him again. But the court was all excitement by now. Alyosha rushed towards him, and the court usher had already seized Ivan by the arm. "What are you about?" he cried, staring into the man's face and suddenly seizing him by the shoulders. He flung him violently to the floor, but the police were on the spot and he was seized. He screamed furiously, and all the time he was being removed, he yelled and screamed something incoherent. The whole court was thrown into confusion. I don't remember everything as it happened. I was excited myself and could not follow. I only know that afterwards, when everything was quiet again and everyone understood what had happened, the court usher came in for the reprimand, though he was very reasonably explained that the witness had been quite well, that the doctors had seen him an hour ago, when he had a slight attack of giddiness, but that, until he had come into the court, he had talked quite consecutively, so that nothing could have been foreseen, that he had, in fact, insisted on giving evidence, but before everyone had completely regained their composure and recovered from his scene, it was followed by another. Katerina Ivanovna had an attack of hysterics. She sobbed, shrieking loudly, but refused to leave the court, struggled and besought them not to remove her. Suddenly she cried to the president, "There is more evidence I must give at once, at once. Here is a document, a letter. Take it, read it quickly, quickly. It's a letter from that monster, that man there." She pointed to Mitya. "It was he killed his father. You will see that directly. He wrote to me how he would kill his father. But the other one is ill. He is ill. He is delirious," she kept crying out beside herself. The court usher took the document she held out to the president, and she, dropping into her chair, hiding her face in her hands, began convulsively and noiselessly, sobbing and shaking all over and stifling every sound for fear she should be ejected from the court. The document she handed up was that letter Mitya had written at the Metropolis Tavern, which Ivan had spoken of as a mathematical proof. Alas, its mathematical conclusiveness was recognized, and had it not been for that letter, Mitya might have escaped his doom, or at least that doom would have been less terrible. It was, I repeat, difficult to notice every detail. What followed is still confused in my mind. The president must, I suppose, have at once passed on the document to the judges, the jury, and the lawyers on both sides. I only remember how they began examining the witness. On being gently asked by the president whether she had recovered sufficiently, Katerina Ivanovna exclaimed impetuously, "I am ready, I am ready, I am quite equal to answering you." She added, evidently still afraid that she would somehow be prevented from giving evidence. She was asked to explain in detail what this letter was and under what circumstances she received it. "I received it the day before the crime was committed, but he wrote it the day before that at the tavern. That is, 2 days before he committed the crime. Look, it is written on some sort of bill. I've got the hiccups, cool," she cried breathlessly. "He hated me at the time because he had behaved contemptuously and was running after that creature, and because he owed me about $3,000, rubles. Oh, he was humiliated by that $3,000 on account of his own meanness. This is how it happened about the $3,000. I beg you, I beseech you to hear me. 3 weeks before he murdered his father, he came to me one morning. I knew he was in want of money. And what he wanted it for, yes, yes, to win that creature and carry her off. I knew then that he had been false to me and meant to abandon me, and it was I, who gave him that money, who offered it to him on the pretext of his sending it to my sister in Moscow. And as I gave it to him, I looked at him in the face and said that he could send it when he liked. In a month's time would do. How could he have failed to understand that I was practically telling him to his face, 'You want money to be false to me with your creature, so here's the money for you. I give it to you myself. Take it if you have so little honour as to take it.' I wanted to prove what he was, and what happened? He took it, and squandered it with that creature in one night. But he knew that I knew all about it. I assure you he understood, too, that I gave him the money to test him, to see whether he was so lost to all his sense of honour as to take it from me. I looked into his eyes, and he looked into mine, and he understood it all, and he took it, he carried off my money." "That's true, Katya," Mitya roared suddenly. "I looked into your eyes, and I knew that you were dishonouring me, and yet I took your money. Despise me as a scoundrel, despise me, all of you. I deserve it." "Prisoner," cried the president, "another word, and I will order you to be removed." "That money was a torment to him," Katya went on with impulsive haste. "He wanted to repay me, he wanted to, that's true, but he needed money for that creature too, so he murdered his father. But he didn't repay me, and went off with her to that village where he was arrested. There again he squandered the money he had stolen after the murder of his father, and a day before the murder he wrote me this letter. He was drunk when he wrote it. I saw it at once. At the time he wrote it from spite, and certainly, feeling certain, positively certain, that I should never show it to anyone, even if he did kill him, or else he wouldn't have written it. for he knew I shouldn't want to revenge myself and ruin him. But read it attentively, more attentively, please, and you will see that he has described it all in his letter, all beforehand, how he would kill his father and where his money was kept. Look, please, don't overlook that there's one phrase there, I shall kill him as soon as Ivan has gone away. He thought it all out beforehand, how he would kill him. Katerina Ivanovna pointed out to the court with venomous and malignant triumph. Oh, it was clear she had studied every line of that letter and detected every meaning underlining it. If he hadn't been drunk, he wouldn't have even written to me. Look, everything is written there beforehand, just as he committed the murder after. A complete program of it, she exclaimed frantically. She was reckless now, with all consequences to herself, though no doubt she had foreseen them even a month ago, for even then, perhaps shaking with laughter, she had pondered whether to show it at trial or not. Now she had taken the fatal plunge. I remember that the letter was read aloud by the clerk directly afterwards, I believe. It made an overwhelming impression. They asked Mitchell whether he admitted having written the letter. It's mine, mine, cried Mitchell. I shouldn't have written it if I hadn't been drunk. We've hated each other for many things, Katya, but I swear I loved you, even while I hated you, and you didn't love me. He sank back on his seat, wringing his hands in despair. The prosecutor and counsel for the defence began cross-examining her, chiefly to ascertain what had influenced her to conceal such a document and to give her evidence in quite a different tone and spirit just before. Yes, yes, I was telling lies just now. I was lying against my honour and my conscience, but I wanted to save him, for he has hated and despised me so, Katya cried madly. Oh, he has despised me horribly. He has always despised me. And do you know, he has despised me from the very moment that I bowed down to him for that money. I saw that. I felt it at once at the time, but for a long time I couldn't believe it. How often I have read it in his eyes. You came of yourself, though. Oh, he didn't understand. He had no idea why I ran to him. He can suspect nothing but baseness. He judged me by himself. He thought everyone was like himself. Katya hissed furiously in a perfect frenzy. And he only wanted to marry me because I'd inherited a fortune. Because of that. I always suspected that I should be trembling with shame all my life before him, because I went to him then, and that he had a right to despise me forever for it, and so to be superior to me. That's why he wanted to marry me. That's so, that's all so. I tried to conquer him by my love, a love that knew no bounds. I even tried to forgive his faithlessness. But he understood nothing. How could he understand, indeed? He is a monster. I only received that letter the next evening. It was brought me from the tavern. And only that morning, I wanted to forgive him everything, even his treachery. The president and the prosecutor, of course, tried to calm her. I can't help thinking that they felt ashamed of taking advantage of her hysteria and of listening to such avowals. I remember hearing them say to her, "We understand how hard it is for you, but be sure we are able to feel for you," and so on and so on. And yet they dragged the evidence out of the raving, hysterical woman. She described at last with extraordinary clearness, which is so often seen, though only for a moment, in such overwrought states, how Ivan had been nearly driven out of his mind during the last 2 months trying to save the monster and the murderer, his brother. "He tortured himself," she exclaimed. "He was always trying to minimize his brother's guilt and confessing to me that he, too, had never loved his father and perhaps desired his death himself. Oh, he has a tender, over-tender conscience. He tormented himself with his conscience. He told me everything. He came every day and talked to me as his only friend. I have the honor to be his only friend," she cried suddenly with a sort of defiance, and her eyes flashed. "He had been twice to see Smerdyakov. One day he came to me and said, 'If it was not my brother, but Smerdyakov committed the murder,' for the legend was circulating everywhere that Smerdyakov had done it. Perhaps I too am guilty, for Smerdyakov knew I didn't like my father, and perhaps believed that I desired my father's death. Then I brought out that letter and showed it to him. He was entirely convinced that his brother had done it, and he was overwhelmed by it. He couldn't endure that thought that his own brother was a parricide. Only a week ago I saw that he was making him ill. During the last few days he has talked incoherently in my presence. I saw his mind was giving way. He walked about raving. He was seen muttering in the streets. The doctors from Moscow, at my request, examined him before yesterday and told me that he was on the eve of brain fever, and all on account of this monster. And last night he learnt that Smerdyakov was dead. It was such a shock that it drove him out of his mind. And all through this monster? All for the sake of saving the monster. Oh, of course, such an outpouring, such an avowal is only possible once in a lifetime, at the hour of death, for instance, on the way to the scaffold. But it was in Katya's character, and it was such a moment in her life, and it was the same impetuous Katya who had thrown herself on the mercy of a young profligate to save her father, the same Katya who had just before, in her pride and chastity, sacrificed herself and her maidenly modesty before all these people, telling of Mitch's generous conduct in her hope of softening his fate a little. And now again she sacrificed herself, but this time it was for another, and perhaps only now, perhaps only at this moment, she felt and knew how dear that other was to her. She had sacrificed herself in terror for him, conceiving all of a sudden that he had ruined himself by this confession, and that it was he who committed the murder, not his brother. She had sacrificed herself to save him, to save his good name, his reputation. And yet one terrible doubt occurred to one. Was she lying in her description of her former relations with Mitcher? That was the question. No, she had not intentionally slandered him when she cried that Mitcher despised her for bowing down to him. She believed it herself. She had been firmly convinced, perhaps even since that bow, that the simple-hearted Mitcher, who even then adored her, was laughing at her and despising her. She had loved him with an hysterical, lacerated love, only from pride, from wounded pride, and that love was not like love, but more like revenge. Oh, perhaps that lacerated love would have grown into real love. Perhaps Katya longed for nothing more than that. But Mitch's faithlessness had wounded her to the bottom of her heart, and her heart could not forgive him. The moment of revenge had come upon her suddenly, and all that had been accumulating so long and so painfully in the offended woman's breast burst out of all at once and unexpectedly. She betrayed Mitya, but she betrayed herself too, and no sooner had she given her full expression to her feelings than the tension, of course, was over, and she was overwhelmed with shame. Hysterics began again. She fell on the floor, sobbing and screaming. She was carried out. At that moment, Krushenka, with a wail, rushed towards Mitya before they had time to prevent her. "Mitya," she wailed, your serpent has destroyed you. There, she has shown you what she is," she shouted to the judges, shaking with anger. At a signal from the president, they seized her and tried to remove her from the court. She wouldn't allow it. She fought and struggled to get back to Mitya. Mitya uttered a cry and struggled to get to her. He was overpowered. Yes, I think the ladies who came to see the spectacle must have been satisfied. The show had been a varied one. Then I remember the Moscow doctor appeared on the scene. I believe the president had previously sent the court usher to arrange for medical aid for Ivan. The doctor announced to the court that the sick man was suffering from a dangerous attack of brain fever and that he must be at once removed. In answer to the questions from the prosecutor and the counsel for the defense, he said that the patient had come to him of his own accord the day before yesterday, and that he had warned him that he had such an attack coming, but he had not consented to be looked after. He was certainly not in a normal state of mind. He told me himself that he saw visions when he was awake, that he met several persons in the street who were dead, and that Satan visited him every evening, said the doctor. In conclusion, having given his evidence and celebrated, the celebrated doctor withdrew. The letter produced by Katerina Ivanovna was added to the material proofs. After some deliberations, the judges decided to proceed with the trial and enter both the unexpected pieces of evidence given by Ivan and Katerina Ivanovna on the protocol. But I will not detail the evidence of the other witnesses, who only repeated and confirmed what had been said before, though all with their characteristic peculiarities. I repeat, all was brought together in the prosecutor's speech, which I shall quote immediately. Everyone was excited, everyone was electrified by the late catastrophe, and all were awaiting the speeches for the prosecution and the defense with intense impatience. Fetyukovich was obviously taken by Katerina Ivanovna's evidence, but the prosecutor was triumphant. When all the evidence had been taken, the court was adjourned for almost an hour. I believe it was just 8 o'clock when the president returned to his seat and our prosecutor, Ippolit Kirillovich, began his speech. All right, there we go. Another chapter done. Have your say about this chapter over at reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. Thank you very much for listening today. I will see you tomorrow.